Critical race theory in schools has become a lightning rod for controversy in the United States. But what exactly is critical race theory, or CRT? It's a theory originating in the 1970s that says racism is not simply a personal prejudice, but rather it's embedded in the formation of the United States and continues to exist in institutions from the criminal justice system to the housing market to the healthcare system. But now opponents have skewed its meaning, claiming critical race theory teaches children to unfairly blame white people for historical ills. However, many argue that opponents have their own agenda to make anti-racism unspeakable. Joining us to discuss this are Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings. She's the president of the National Academy of Education and professor emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her latest book is titled Culturally Relevant Pedagogy, Asking a Different Question. And Sam Holdley Brill is a PhD candidate at the City University of New York Graduate Center and a research and writing fellow at the African American Policy Forum. I want to thank you both for joining me. Gloria, I'm going to start with you. According to Education Week, 44 states have introduced bills or they've taken other steps that would restrict teaching critical race theory in schools or would otherwise regulate how teachers can discuss racism, sexism, and issues of systemic inequality inside of schools. Given that we're living in a moment when black people are being murdered by police, where state violence is a leading cause of death for young black men in the United States, all this stuff is happening. Can you talk to me a little bit about the significance of the movement to rewrite or even erase the history of race and the experiences of black Americans and other minorities in the country?
Yeah, I think not only is the timing fascinating, the larger historical context here is that the U.S. has been a place that has always participated in the censorship of certain ideas. And we know in the 1850s, for example, there were multiple states that outlawed any material that spoke of anti-slavery, that we had a black minister by the name of Sam Green, who spent 10 years in prison for just possessing Uncle Tom's Cabin. So now we know as of March 31st of last year, there were something like 1,586 book bans in 86 school districts across some 26 states. So the idea of restricting this knowledge or restricting this information is not new to the U.S., and it's always about power and control.
That's a fascinating point, Sam, that there's a long history of book bans, a long history of trying to prohibit information and ideas that highlight the contradictions of American empire, that speak to racism, that speak to all this stuff that we're trying to get at here. And yet, it's happening again at a particular historical moment. Why now? Why is it that in the last few years we're starting to see the legislation come through? We're starting to see all these states say, no critical race theory in my city, not in my backyard. Why is it happening now?
Well, it's interesting because we know, as a matter of fact, because the people who are leading this crusade against critical race theory, against what they call wokeness, they tell us why they're doing it. They have said explicitly, Christopher Rufo is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's also worked at the Heritage Foundation. He's worked at the Claremont Institute.
Those are conservative American think tanks.
Yeah. He's worked at all of them, all of the major conservative American think tanks that are funded by hundreds of millions of dollars to pump out this propaganda, to manipulate public opinion, to tell people that they need to fear certain things, to create moral panics. And what Christopher Rufo has said explicitly about the language of critical race theory is that it has been the single most effective linguistic tool in the fight against Black Lives Matter, specifically Black Lives Matter. Because when you frame it around critical race theory, it fits this particular framing that's become very popular in conservative media and among right-wing politicians, is that there's this liberal elite, and they hate America. They hate ordinary Americans, and they want to push their values on you.
Gloria, to what extent is this a response to the, not just the murder of George Floyd, but the kind of movements that emerged after the killing of George Floyd? Sam talks about this being a response to Black Lives Matter. There was a racial reckoning in the United States, allegedly, after that, where we were talking about race and white supremacy. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing book bans. I'm seeing people upset about what's happening in first grade classrooms. Are the two connected?
Yeah, I think they are connected. And I think what actually happened is that there was kind of almost like scales falling from people's eyes when you saw what happened with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. People were beginning to say, oh, well, no, wait, maybe these aren't just isolated incidents. America loves the narrative of the individual. You can't actually sell a book or a movie or a TV show unless you have the heroic individual. And so the fact that it's starting not to be just about individuals, that it's about systems and organizations. So I think beginning to see the systemic way in which racism operates in the nation is what is causing a big part of the, you know, in some ways the uprising of people, and then this pushback on the right, on the very conservative, very racist, quite frankly, response to it.
Sam, in the 2021-2022 school year, and Gloria spoke to this a moment ago, there were more than 1,600 books that were banned from school districts. Now, these books include books like The Bluest Eye and Beloved by Toni Morrison, The Color Purple by Alice Walker. Now, some of these books are 30 years old, some are more than 50 years old. Why are they banning them now?
Well, the reasons behind the parents challenging the books, in many cases, I think, are because they have a certain attachment to their conception of themselves and their parents and their grandparents and all of perhaps going back generations in the United States. And they don't want their child to perhaps learn that maybe they themselves or their grandma or grandpa had certain views about things that were going on in perhaps the civil rights movement, school desegregation, in perhaps their view of the Civil War. And they don't want their child to be taught versions of history that conflict with the sort of mythological, patriotic America as a shining city on a hill narrative that so many people push on their children.
And what they do, Gloria, which I find interesting, is they don't say what Sam just said. I could almost accept that. They'd be wrong. I disagree with them. But if they said, look, we're white, we like being white, it's working out great for us, and we don't want anything to unsettle what whiteness means to us, I could at least accept the honesty. But what they often do is reframe the books, right? Martin Luther King and the March to Washington. It's a book for kids. And they say, we can't have it in school because of photographs of political violence. Ruby Bridges Goes to School, which is a story about integration of school, getting this little girl into school because of white domestic terrorism in the United States in the 1950s and 60s. They say, we can't have the book because it has racist remarks. I mean, that is rich to me, right? We can't show you the book about Martin Luther King because he's getting beat and they getting beat. They're the ones beating them. It's mind-boggling to me. This feels like backwards world. This feels like something from, like, Orwell.
I would agree, Mark, but I also want to put in context for your viewers that we are talking about an incredibly vocal and powerful minority. The latest NPR Ipsos poll indicates that 72% of parents want their kids to learn more about racism. So we're allowing the tail to wag the dog on this thing. And, you know, you take a state like Texas that has something like 713 book bans.
Sam, Gloria said it's a small but vocal minority. And she's right. But this is also a small, vocal, and well-funded, well-organized minority. Groups like Moms for Liberty are the ones going around the country pushing this stuff. They have 200 chapters. These are parent activists. I'm using scare quotes because sometimes I've gone to some of these cities. I was in South Carolina 2 weeks ago, and I'm watching these groups go to parent-teacher night. I'm watching them go to school board meetings complaining that their kid is getting this crazy curriculum in South Carolina. And these parents clearly ain't from South Carolina. They ain't know South Carolina from South Africa. But they are organized enough to make it seem as if they're outraged parents when, in fact, they're advancing a political agenda, in my estimation. Talk to me about these groups and how powerful they are and how they came to be so.
Yeah, these groups are very powerful indeed, and so much of their power comes from portraying themselves as grassroots activists, concerned parents, right? So much of the outrage at school boards is focused on ways that the material that they have challenges to allegedly corrupts their children in certain ways. And it makes you think about what white innocence, what value that has, because the conversation is never about how banning these books would impact the sort of psyche of a black child in the classroom. It's never about that.
You know, in the last 3 years, despite all the tragedy, there has been a national conversation on race. Young people are having more nuanced and complicated conversations around identity, around power, around difference. Books like 1619 Project, authors like Ibram Kendi are attempting to unpack American history and put a spotlight on some things that we ignored before or understated, at least some parts of the population. Given all of that, are you all seeing a shift in the way that young people are talking and thinking about race and identity?
One of the things to be hopeful about, Mark, is the fact that there are coalitions building. So while it is a very anti-Black attack, it's also an anti-gay attack. It's an anti-trans attack. It is, so these, you know, identities go across racial lines. And so you are seeing a kind of coalition of people saying, we have to pull together to stop this. And our young people, they just don't think of race and gender and sexuality in the same categories as previous generations. They are much more fluid in their thinking. And anybody who knows anything about adolescent development knows that the one way to get young people to do something is to tell them they can't. So I'm excited about what our young people are about to do.
And I want to thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you both so much.
All right, everybody. That is our show. Upfront, we'll be back next week.